Hello, friends. Welcome to Keep Singing, a Beth Green and Bethel and Daryl Dixon podcast. I am your host, Sunny, Dynamic Symmetry, pretty much all over the place. Primarily Tumblr, but all over the place. And welcome to episode 5, I think. I'm not going to check right now, but I think it's 5. So that's cool. I was going to record this... God, I think I was going to record it last week, and a bunch of shit happened, and I wasn't able to, and then I was going to record it at the end of last week, and then a bunch of shit happened, and I wasn't able to, and then I thought, well, mid-season premiere is coming. I could just, you know, see what happens then and see if I have anything to talk about. And you know what? It turns out that I do. Because the theme of this particular episode is darkness and violence, and I think that the episode gave us some stuff to discuss there, even if it's not directly related to the ship or Beth Green, clearly, or even Daryl, because he was in it. He was in it a couple times, and it was amazing. And I needed minutes after that. Anyway, violence and darkness, not specifically violence, but darkness and disturbing themes and horror and all kinds of stuff that is not fluff, angst too. And how it fits not only into fic, because I don't want to just talk about fic, but into fan works in general in this fandom. Because I'm really into dark stuff, as you know, if you've read any of my fic. And I also am I'm not entirely sure how that happened. I'm a horror writer in my professional career. Very weird. Don't even get me into how that happened. I thought I was going to be a science fiction and fantasy writer. But we're going to dig into that today. And in fact, we have that, and we have a question that somebody posed to me on Tumblr that I thought was interesting enough that rather than respond there, I wanted to dig into that a little bit here. And, God, especially because... I'm having such an afternoon, you guys. I just got called racist, as you know, if you just looked at my Tumblr just now, which is kind of fun. And I had some ugly shit sent at me right around the time of the premiere, which is not unusual. I was expecting it. I was actually a little surprised that I didn't get more than I got. We all get that at specific times. I don't think any of us are unused to it at this point. But yeah, it's been an afternoon, and my eyes are really bothering me, and I have kind of a headache, so we'll see how coherent I manage to be throughout this thing. But anyway, yeah, see? I have enough stuff to get to today, and I have that question that I want to address that I think, and I apologize for this, because I think that it's an important and interesting part of the show. Important and interesting part of the show. I'm going to dispense with the Rex this time. Again, I apologize for that, because I really like giving a spotlight to great people in the fandom, but I really want to be able to dig into stuff today, and I don't want to end up taking, like, 2 fucking hours. Especially not given that I have this amazing reading for you that I'm so happy I was able to do. It's Scar Tissue by Vampire Cat. So before we get into that, before we get into actually the serious subject matter regarding darkness, I want to get into a question that was posed to me about the ship itself and about whether or not it's problematic in a specific way. So the discussion was about somebody who has a friend who is anti the ship, and the reason that she gave was that, I'm quoting directly from this message now, she said it's because she thinks it's a sexist pairing that further promotes the prevalent and cliché societal and cultural institution of the much younger woman being with an older man. She says this is not a healthy thing to encourage with today's young girls. Now, see, I think this is an interesting question. First of all, I think it's interesting because I don't think it's something that any of us haven't heard before. First of all, whenever shit gets thrown at us, you know the age gap is pretty much one of the primary things that people employ as ammunition. But not only that, what I want to say to start this off, and I think I've said this before, is that I think that there actually is something to that criticism. I think that it's, although clearly it's not something I actually directly agree with, it's coming from a place of legitimate criticism because it actually is a thing. And I think I talked about this some back during the first Smut Week episode when I was talking about Daddy Kink and talking about why I and other people like it and why, yeah, it is problematic, and I think that we should like it without pretending that it's not. Because I think that if you're going to be a responsible person in the world, part of that is owning your shit. You know, even when it's really uncomfortable for you, especially when it's really uncomfortable for you, because what the fuck is anything worth if you don't go to uncomfortable places? You never grow as a human being. Anyway, I absolutely agree. I don't see how anybody couldn't agree that there is a thing in our culture where young girls are sexualized in a way that's incredibly unhealthy. Not prepubescent girls, necessarily, but girls who are not too far past adolescence, teenage girls. And teenage girls who are arguably kind of sexually mature, but not really. We sexualize feminine childishness in a way that's not good. We infantilize feminine sexuality in a way that's not good. And as we do that, we also have this thing where we match up older men with them a lot of the time. And you don't just see this with very young women and much older men. You see this on kind of a smaller scale in Hollywood, for example. I forget exactly where I saw this, but it wasn't that long ago, and it's not the first time I've seen it. Some data rolling by, it was either on my dash or it was actually in one of the textbooks I'm using for my gender class, which I'm loving, by the way, about how a lot of the leading men in Hollywood, many of whom are well into or past middle age and are still doing quite well, get paired up in movies with love interests who are considerably their junior. And I think that you can't deny that it's a thing. And in fact, I think that I saw that one of the things that has emerged is that gap, in some cases at least, is increasing. Now, these are not young women. You know, these are women in their late 20s, early 30s, if not a little bit older. But there's still an age gap there, and you rarely see older men paired with women who are roughly their age. There is something about that marketing departments have decided is not appealing to us. And I think some of it is just that when women age, they're just kind of made to disappear. No, older women just don't have a place in culture. They're made invisible, even though they're all around us, as happens with so many things. But I think it's also that we are inclined to pair older men with younger women. And I think that's a problem. And I think that we need to recognize that it's a problem. And I think that it's fair to say that because it's a problem, and because it's something that if you take it to an extreme is actually very taboo, that's one of the reasons why people get off on it sexually. And these are people who are not pedophiles, and these are people who are, you know, maybe, like, serious feminists. Like, maybe radical feminists, like me. Who also are like, yeah, this thing's incredibly fucking problematic, but I really like it. And I'm not gonna pretend that I don't. So when things are unhealthy in culture, I think that that's one of the things that actually makes them sexually exciting to us. But that's not exactly what's going on here. What's going on here, this person says or is afraid of, is that this is just the perpetuation of this thing that I talked about, where we pair younger women with older men, and that's presented as normalized, and it's normalized and it's presented as acceptable and even healthy, rather than something that is up for criticism, which obviously it should be, because everything should be. So there, yeah. When it comes to that, I'm totally willing to own and emphasize that that's a problem. Now, the thing that I think that we don't do, or that a lot of us don't do when it comes to the problematic aspects of this kind of gendered age gap relationship, because we do see younger men with much older women very much. And when we do, they're usually presented in a very different way, which is a whole other conversation and which I think is very interesting, but it has nothing to do with this particular ship. So I'm not going to talk about it here. That's a topic for my gender class. There's nothing about this particular age relationship, gendered age relationship, that in itself is unhealthy. And let me clarify what I mean by that for anybody who is wondering why the hell I just said it's a problem and now I appear to be saying it's not a problem. This is where I become all sociologic-y and say, and this is something I think pretty much everybody listening to this would be completely 100% with me on, we're talking here about a social construction. There is nothing in age intrinsically that means anything socially. We socially construct everything, we socially construct age, and we socially construct relationships that are affected in some sense by age. Sorry about the thumping, they're assholes across the way who keep slamming their car doors. Anyway, there are aspects of this, well, really all of it, that there's nothing intrinsic here. You can look at a younger woman and an older man if you can possibly do this in a way that's divorced of culture, and you can't. There's just really no way to do that. But if somehow by some magic you could do that, there would be nothing there that would automatically be a problem. The problem happens when you have socially constructed power dynamics that exist within the concept of a culture that is patriarchal, very strongly patriarchal, where men have the power and women don't, and especially younger women don't have the power. And then you add to that the sexualization of younger women and the fact that older men are dominant, and then the fact that we construct masculinity in such a way that men, if they're actual men, you know, quote-unquote real men, have an insatiable appetite for sex and are looking for it all the time and are aggressive about it. To the point of sexual assault and rape. It's part of rape culture. We normalize rape. We don't necessarily say rape is good, but we normalize it. And we excuse it to some degree because we consider it just sort of part of masculinity. So all of this stuff is woven into understanding an age gap relationship in this way. And that's why it is legitimately a problem. The person I was talking to about this, I don't think actually would agree with me exactly on this point, although perhaps I'm putting words in this person's mouth, that I personally, and I might be letting down the side here a little bit, I personally would look at an age gap relationship like Beth and Daryl's, where we're talking to somebody who's either an older teenager, because, you know, I think she's probably 18 or 19, she's technically still a teenager. You know, she's not a teenager in the sense we think of teenagers, but she's technically a teenager. And a guy who is approaching, if not actually in middle age. This is a big age gap. He's probably literally twice her age. I would look at something like that in real life, and without knowing anything about it individually, but knowing about how culture works, I would probably start from a position where I didn't think it was healthy. And maybe that's incredibly unfair, and maybe I shouldn't do that, but that nevertheless, that is something I would do. I regard that kind of relationship as probably unhealthy in any instance, while recognizing that there are lots of cases in which it isn't. It's not an innocent until proven guilty thing for me. I would look at it and automatically think, there may be something there that's not so great, and be totally willing to be proved wrong, but you see my point. So the thing about Beth and Daryl is that if the power dynamics in these age gap relationships are what make them a problem and not the age gap relationships themselves, then what redeems Beth and Daryl and in fact makes them so great is that the power dynamics in that relationship do not work in the way that they do in age gap relationships that are unhealthy and bad. And this is something I don't even think I need to go into very much detail about, because this is something we talk about constantly. The power dynamics in this relationship are not tilted in Daryl's favor. They are egalitarian, or they're tilted heavily in Beth's favor. She has a tremendous amount of the power. She is a girl who is not going to be manipulated or pushed into anything she doesn't want to do. We've seen evidence of that over and over again. You know, Daryl hasn't tried to manipulate her or anything. Personally, I don't believe Daryl is capable of manipulating anybody. I just don't think that's part of his character. It's not that I think that he's, you know, stupid or anything, because clearly I think he's one of the smartest guys on the show, but I don't think it's in his nature to be able to do that. So clearly he hasn't tried to do that, but he also hasn't tried to really do anything else that we would, you know, sort of put into that kind of relationship. And when he has been aggressive with her and borderline abusive, she has absolutely not fucking taken it. She's been very, very clear about the fact that she will absolutely not take this from him. And she's broken him over it. Like, he's broken down. So I can't really think of a more dramatic demonstration of that, especially in Still, that the dynamics here are not working that way. That something very different is going on here. And for that reason, obviously, I don't find this a problematic relationship. I will own that it is situated within a problematic cultural trope, and that it is situated within the context of a society that is intensely patriarchal and very misogynist. But this as an individual thing, I can't consider that way, because I just know for a fact that it's not, because I know these characters. And with anything harmful or problematic in culture, I think that we have to recognize that there can be exceptions, and that those exceptions don't disprove the rule. If anything, those exceptions prove the rule, because the exceptions are themselves exceptional. So but me thinking that Beth and Daryl is healthy, which I do, I think it's a wonderful example of a very healthy relationship, sexual or otherwise, that to me doesn't make everything else not a problem. For me, it emphasizes that it is a problem. And one of the reasons why I really like the relationship is that I think that it provides us a way to engage with that problem in a way that we can't in a lot of other instances. We can come at harmful stuff in culture, or at least, you know, if we want. It's something I enjoy doing because I'm a fucking nerd. We can come at harmful stuff in culture in a way that we couldn't otherwise because we have this wonderful exception to work from. And if we're going to look at how something's an exception, we have to know what it's an exception of. And I love that. I mean, I love everything about this relationship. I don't think that this comes as a surprise to anybody if you're fucking listening to this. So, not problematic. I don't think. Situated within a problematic thing, but not problematic. Now, the other part of this question that I think is so interesting, and this is something I think I also talked about a little bit with the Smut Week episodes when I talked a little about 50 Shades of Grey, and that is this a healthy thing to depict? By depicting this relationship, are we reinforcing this trope? Are we presenting this thing as desirable in a way that is harmful to people? And in fact, that, you know, that's another thing that people come at us with. We're bad people because we are encouraging and producing and reproducing and taking pleasure in something that it's in itself is harmful, so we are therefore harmful people. Clearly, I think that's bullshit. However, I think that's a question that's still worth considering. Because I think that the effect that media and stories have on culture is extremely worth considering. Again, cultural sociologist, teaching a gender course. Clearly, this is going to be on my mind. And I honestly think there's no easy answer to this. This is something where I think you just kind of have to stand back and admit that there's really no good, satisfying yes or no answer. The answer is yes and no simultaneously. And I'll tell you why I feel that way. And again, I think this kind of goes back to some of the stuff I maybe said about 50 Shades. Let's jump to something like Twilight. Now, when Twilight came out, fair cop, I've never actually read Twilight. I've just read a lot about Twilight. I've seen the movie, read all the analysis. I've read large excerpts, but I've never actually read the whole book start to finish, so let me just issue that as a caveat. Anyway, when Twilight first came out and I first started hearing about some of the things in it that people were finding a little bit worrying regarding an abusive relationship, one of the things that people were concerned about, and that I personally think that it's completely legitimate to be concerned about, is this delivering a message to impressionable young girls who are getting a sense of what a healthy relationship looks like, that this is something desirable, that this is an ideal, and that they should not only expect but welcome unhealthy behavior from someone because they love them. And this is something that has been in stories directed toward young girls forever. I mean, it's just, it's kind of always been there. Twilight is only one of the more recent and more extreme examples of it, partly because it was just so popular. And I think that it's fair to be concerned about that. I think that worrying about the kinds of stories that we tell and what effect that they have on people, especially people who are undergoing intense periods of identity formation, which you are as an adolescent. When you're an adolescent girl, you are figuring out what the fuck is going on. And it's true if you're an adolescent boy. It's true whatever kind of adolescent you are. This is a significant formative period in your life where if certain things hit you that aren't so great and nothing happens along the way to course correct, it can be a problem. And especially if you haven't been taught growing up how to look at things critically. And we are very, very bad at teaching children. And this is something you can teach, I think, when children are quite young. We're very, very bad at teaching children to look at things critically. It's something that we need to address, and I don't see any way in which we really can, because I think most of us don't regard it as an issue. But anyway, I think that it's worth being concerned about that. That said, the more I thought about it, and the more I saw the criticisms that people were issuing regarding Twilight, and I think that you can say the exact same thing about 50 Shades, and to be honest, I think you can say the exact same thing about some of the fic that I've written. I think that there was an element of condescension in a lot of these criticisms that I saw, and in particular, there was an element of gendered condescension. Because there is also this thing that shows up over and over again in culture where young girls are seen as these pure things that have to be protected, who are not savvy enough and intelligent enough to know what they want and to be able to look at something and distinguish between fantasy and reality, and distinguish between, okay, this is something that it's fun to think about, I enjoy this as something fictional, but this isn't something I would actually want in my real life. This isn't actually something that I would regard as healthy if it happened specifically to me. The distinction between reality and fantasy is something we just don't... I mean, I think in general it's not something that we trust people to be able to handle, but I think in particular we don't trust young girls to be able to handle it. And I think that's a really serious problem. So one of the things that I really didn't like about that was that I saw what I felt was a tendency to take probably very smart young girls and deny them the right to fantasize and deny them the right to grow within the context and the construction of their own fantasies. And fantasy is so important for growing because it's self-storytelling. The stories that you receive from outside are incredibly important, I think, to identity formation, but the stories that you tell yourself are even more important. And to be able to tell yourself creative and powerful and imaginative stories is, I think, part of what enables us to become healthy human beings who can engage with the world in a healthy and reasonably safe fashion. So I think it's very important to both be aware that this is potentially an issue, but also to be aware that we really need to not foreclose on the opportunity to allow children to do this. And in particular, girls. Because, God, you know what? It sucks to be a young girl in our culture. I mean, there's lots of things that it's worse to be. It's worse to be a trans kid. It's worse to be a queer kid in a lot of ways. Clearly, it's worse in some respects to be a young black man. But being a young girl fucking sucks. I mean, all these things suck, just in really different ways. And, you know, also intersectionality. Hi. But young girls get lots of shit. And I'm for anything that removes some of that shit from the equation. So while Twilight troubled me and while I thought that it raised some issues that were worth discussion, there were some things about the criticisms of Twilight that I found really problematic and didn't like. And I think that the attitude that, okay, this relationship is bad to depict or is part of something bad, and that I therefore don't support it because I don't think it's a healthy thing to encourage. I'm not going to tell somebody that their reaction to something is wrong necessarily, but I think that it's more complicated than that. I think in general, I wish that that wasn't the norm. In general, I wish that that wasn't presented as the ideal. I wish not that it would go away, but that there were alternatives presented as normative. Again, the problem with things that are normative is that they're presented without criticism, that they're just presented as automatically healthy. They're fine. They're the norm. They're normal. So I wish there was more of that. But the thing about Beth and Daryl, again, is that it's such a healthy relationship. So while I think that it's very important, ideally, for anybody, and I don't know how many fucking young girls are watching the show. I have a sense it's probably not the biggest audience segment. But to the extent that anybody impressionable, that's a really problematic word too, the sense to which anybody impressionable is watching the show, I think that it's important to be aware of the fact that 99.999999% of guys are not Daryl. They're just not. Your odds of meeting a Daryl are vanishingly small. And I think it's important to recognize that, as tragic a fact as that is. But I also think that it's a really good relationship to depict simply because, again, it is so healthy. It is so egalitarian. I think one of the reasons why so many of us love Beth is because she is so much of a feminist character. She is so sure of herself, and she is coming into an understanding of her own power right before she's fucking shot. And she's absolutely not taking anything lying down from this guy who's much older and much bigger than she is and could really do her physical damage if he wanted to. And she is determined to be a survivor in this world in which, you know, the party line is that people like her don't survive in this world. She's determined to prove everybody wrong. And I think that's a wonderful character to have in a show like this. I think that's a wonderful character for people to see because it's an alternative to what we usually see, and it encourages an alternative. And I think that Beth and Daryl together encourage an alternative because the relationship between them is just so different and it's so healthy. I look at it and I think there's nothing predatory about this relationship. There's nothing manipulative about this relationship. Were this relationship to become sexual, it would become sexual because she wanted it to be. It would become sexual on her terms. And it wouldn't necessarily have to be sexual at all. They can have an intensely intimate relationship, romantic even, and never have it be sexual. And I love the possibility of that too, just because we never see that. Romance and sex are inextricably linked in our stories. We never separate the two. So yeah, that's my very long-winded answer to this question of whether or not this is a problematic thing to depict in this context. So it's kind of yeah, but no. And that, if nothing else, it raises some issues that I think are really worth talking about. The problem is, the people who are always the ones to bring these issues up aren't actually interested in discussing them. They just make them into a club that they can, like Negan and Glenn, just pummel us over the head with. And that's not productive. That's not a good discussion. It's not one I'm interested in having. The end. Okay, moving on to the actual theme of this particular episode. Partly it started because I'm in the middle of a work in progress, which some of you may be reading, called Everything Where It Belongs, which is probably now the most disturbing thing I've ever written in this fandom. And it may be one of the most disturbing things I've ever written, period. It's bad, and it just keeps getting worse, and I fully intend to do that. I'm exploring the extent to which I can tell a dark story in this fandom and still do it well, without it just becoming so ridiculous that it's no longer good. And the thing about this fic is that I've tagged it to hell and back. I mean, of course I have. There's absolutely terrible stuff in it, and I don't want anybody wandering into it and getting struck in the face by something that they didn't see coming, to the extent that I can do that. So, you know, it's tagged for things like sexual violence and self-harm and suicidal thoughts and violent thoughts and mental illness and, you know, basically everything I can think of that would be upsetting, it's tagged with. It's not tagged with anything fun like smut or fluff or poetry or, you know, any of the other things that I would normally tag stuff with. It's just, here is the list of everything awful that you can expect to encounter. So proceed very, very much at your own risk. So I wrote this thing, I'm writing this thing, I have all these tags, and I'm adding more periodically as more awful things occur. I think there probably will be more. No, in fact, I know there'll be more. I know I'm going to be adding more awful tags to this thing. Oh, God, I'm so excited. And I sort of wondered, okay, I'm shocked, kind of on a regular basis, that not only are people following this thing, but that people are following this thing and actually still appear to be kind of enjoying it on some level. I mean, I am. On some uncomfortable levels, but I'm me, and I was somewhat surprised and quite pleased to see that although I don't think a lot of people are reading it, it has its fans, and those fans are happy with it so far. But it got me thinking about the place of darkness in this fandom and in this ship, and darkness of all kinds. Angst, violence, disturbing themes, horror, whatever horror means to you. So I put out a question on Tumblr where it had to do with me thinking about tags and what brings people into fix and what tags actually do and the purposes that they serve, whether they are presenting attractive things to people that they're looking for, or whether they are presenting things that people should be aware of before they proceed because they might be really upsetting and even triggering. So I asked, you know, it kind of was an informal poll. How many of you actively avoid stuff tagged with graphic violence, disturbing themes, horror-associated stuff? And for how many of you is this actually an attraction? And I ask that question because, for me, it's always an attraction. Pretty much always. There are places I won't go. I'll say that much. There are things that I absolutely don't want anything to do with and that I'll turn around and walk away from. But for the most part, tag your stuff with disturbing shit and I am there. If you're a good writer, I'm 100% there. I mean, I don't mind telling you guys that I watch torture porn films for fun to relax while I grade. And I do that because they're deeply stupid and don't require a whole lot of my attention. And I can grade while I watch them and they make it a little less miserable. And I just love gore also. Absolutely love splatter. I love horror. I regard torture porn films as very deeply stupid horror. It's not the kind of horror that I really prefer when I'm seriously watching horror, but I like them. So that's something that you should know about me, I think. That for me, disturbing tags are usually attractions. I'm very happy to go there. But I know that a lot of people aren't. And the other thing that I know about this fandom is that there is enough darkness in this particular ship. I mean, one party of it may be dead. And in all likelihood, from a particular perspective, is dead, and is dead in a really stupid way. And the other party, the party of the second part, is wandering around like a dead man, and his life has been kind of low-key ruined. kind of high-key ruined. And this is not a happy situation at all. It looked like it might be for a little while, and now it's just fucking terrible. So we obviously have, if fan fiction and other fan works are a response to canon in part as a way of resisting canon and saying, no, you absolutely do not get to tell this kind of story. I reject your reality and I replace it with my own. Then a lot of what we're writing is fun and fluffy and happy. And I've written so much fucking stuff that's fun and fluffy and happy. And I think that that's something that we want. I think that's something that we really have a need for because of how terrible things are. But I was also kind of wondering, you know, for how many people is this something that they actually also want to explore the darker side of? Because again, there is a lot of darkness in this ship. Darkness is sort of intrinsically part of it. So I got a number of interesting responses to this, and I'm not going to address like all of them one by one, because a lot of them had similar themes and went to similar places. And also, if I read each one, we would be here for 3 hours, and I don't really want to do that to you, although I know some of you like it when this thing is long. Anyway, I got a number of responses that touched on a number of similar themes. And one of the primary ones that I got, and I kind of just talked about this, is that the show itself is disturbing. I mean, if you picked a genre for this show, it's a horror show. It's about zombies. It's incredibly gory. People die all the fucking time. People are really miserable all the fucking time. There's dread. There's terror. These people live in fear of everybody because, you know, not only do you have to contend with walkers, but they're better than average odds that the people that you run into who are strangers do not have your best interests in mind and may be lethal threats right off the bat. So this is not a happy world. One of the things I really like about the show is that even now, I think that it's maintaining a theme of it may still be possible to construct light in the dark. That, you know, like Laurie says as she's dying, you know, we can fight this world. Or, you know, Bob says, you know, nightmares, they shouldn't end who you are. And I think that the show really believes that. I think that really is kind of the central theme. Nevertheless, it's a terrible world. And that means that even if you leave apart the fact that this ship appears to have completely capsized, there's a lot of darkness interwoven with it. These are two characters who come from very painful places. Daryl is deeply traumatized. Even if he's doing better with Beth after Still, he still has so much healing to do. He still has major, major darkness inside him that he hasn't really confronted yet. And Beth herself, although, you know, she's a very hopeful person and she's all about faith and love, and she's got some darkness in her too. I mean, she's with her depression and her suicide attempt, and God, like watching her walk her mother killed in front of her by Daryl, by the way, which, oh God, like I don't think anybody's ever addressed that like on the show, but that's fucking awful and kind of great. There's a lot of darkness in her. She's faced death in a number of different ways, and she's experienced the worst kind of loss, and she's maintained her spirit in the face of that, and that's why she's not a naive little girl, and in fact, her strength, her optimism is strength. It's not stupid. The strongest kind of hope is the kind of hope that perseveres through all the stuff that's trying to kill it. She's strong in a way I think few people on the show are. Glenn is another guy who's strong. Tyrese was strong that way before he died. So yeah, so she's got a lot of darkness, but she's also very representative of light. And in fact, that's one of the things that a couple people said was that if you want to really get into the literal darkness and light in this ship, there's really clear and blatant color symbolism going on. I mean, look at Still, especially. Beth is all bright color. Beth is in the sunlight. Beth is always brightly lit. Daryl is always dark in the shadows, especially when he's standing next to her. There's a very hard contrast. He is always the darker of the two. And in fact, her brightness is emphasized by his darkness and vice versa. And we've seen that continue since Coda. I mean, he's just getting darker and darker and darker. And basically, at this point, he's ash-colored. He's just char and ash, which I love, by the way. There's literal symbolism going on here. And that symbolism is there because the writers are putting this out as a theme to explore. Darkness and light. And one of the things that is one of my very favorite parts of Still, and this is something of a digression from disturbing themes, but I have to mention just because I fucking love it so much. Right after she hugs him, and she kind of, I mean, there's like impact, like she bumps into him and he's sort of pushed forward. And as he's starting to break, he's been in the shadows like the whole time. As he's starting to break, he raises his head and sunlight hits his face. And you see his face like breaking open. I think that's one of the most wonderful moments I've seen on the show, to be perfectly honest. And it's just a few seconds, but I think that it was perfectly intentional. I think it was absolutely planned. I think that everything about that was shot in such a way that that would happen, because I think that these people are very attentive to detail. And I think that Norman's acting right at that moment is just stunning. And I think that that moment is one of the fundamental elements of this relationship and darkness and light, and what happens when the two of them come together, because at that moment he's in the light. He kind of goes back to the dark again, but he's in the light there, and that's huge. So there's that. There are literal things going on here with darkness and light. But if you want to go away from symbolism again, the darkness in terms of angst and in terms of sadness and in terms of pain and suffering is very much there too. And that's one of the things that I really loved about the ship before everything went horribly wrong. And Team Defiance, warning for a moment. If Beth returns, that's one of the things that will make me very happy about it, because it will probably be a continuation of that theme. Because I don't personally think that they would do so much with it and then just completely drop it, assuming she does come back. So yeah, suffering and pain and how we come through that and how we grow and the people who help us recover is so, so important here. And those are dark themes, and in some sense I think those are disturbing. But those aren't actually the specific things that I was talking about, because the stuff that I was talking about is stuff that really goes much deeper than that. Deeper in a more overt way than the show has done, despite the fact that the show itself is very disturbing and dark. And one of the things that I specifically mentioned was graphic violence, in part because it's one of the things that you tag for, and it is one of the things that, I mean, people find a lot of things disturbing, but I think that's one of the things that people avoid. You know, they don't necessarily want that. If you're watching the show, clearly on some level you're okay with graphic violence, but I think some people don't necessarily want that in their fic. And I think that depending on the kind of violence, people aren't too happy with it in other ways also. And the thing about the season, the mid-season premiere that I think a lot of people weren't so thrilled with, and I personally, to be honest, didn't have so much of an issue with it, but I saw some critical reaction to the effect of this is stupid. And I saw some reaction from people I know to the effect of this is stupid. And okay, I actually kind of thought some of it was stupid too. It just didn't bother me nearly as much as I think it bothered other people. The deaths on that show, and the fact that for a little while there, it felt like it was just kind of descending into gore shock value, which is very Kirkman. I've said that one of the things that this feels like to me is that at least for a while now, Kirkman has been kind of, as an influence, if nothing else, been kind of stepping to the fore and determining, or at least his source material, is determining in a much more direct way how things proceed. And his source material, although it has pretensions to higher themes and sometimes even reaches them, is very much about gory shock value. I mean, that's kind of just what it is. He's a fuckboy. It's where he goes when he wants to do something impressive, and that's lazy. It's just incredibly lazy. And one of the things that people seem to feel about the mid-season premiere was that it really had some lazy aspects to it. And I think that that is something that the show could slip into that is a problem. I don't think it's quite there yet, and I don't think that the mid-season premiere necessarily plunges it into that in a way from which it can't recover. And in fact, I'm, believe it or not, for a number of reasons, I'm actually really hopeful about the rest of the season. And if you will allow me a quick digression here that has nothing to do with darkness, really, I'll tell you why. And I was talking about this with Sparks of Green yesterday, I think, and I kind of had a little bit of a revelation. I think that why I feel better about this season is that the Alexandria plot is sort of over now. And it started in 5B, and it's continued through 6A. And what it was doing, and why it was in some ways a problem, was that it was establishing the safe zone as something that Team Family will fight for. Because they didn't really have a reason to do that up until that point. When they first get to the zone, the only reason they really have to fight for it is that it's a safe haven. And in fact, Rick is perfectly willing to just completely take it from these people by force. He's not interested in protecting them necessarily. I mean, maybe he'll protect them against their will, but he doesn't feel anything for them as his own people. And we needed this season-long plot in order to establish that Team Family, and Rick especially, no longer feels that way. That they now have adopted this as the new prison, and that they're going to defend it accordingly, which means that when Negan arrives, there will be something at stake in the conflict that follows. I'm actually all for that. Looking back now, I think that this plot was completely reasonable and had to be there. I just hate the way it was executed. But it also was very much a Kirkman plot, and I think that we really saw a lot of that on Sunday. And look, I mean, I've kind of already tipped my hand when I said that I really enjoy torture porn. I like graphic violence. Like, I'm all for it. The thing about a good story is that it should be gratuitous, and this is kind of a cliche. You know, oh, don't make violence gratuitous. But no, don't make violence gratuitous. Everything in your story should serve the fucking story, or it shouldn't be there. Nothing should be there that isn't doing a job, and if the job that it's doing is to shock people, it's a bad job, it's lazy, and you shouldn't do that. So one of the criticisms of, you know, the show in general, and I think that The Last Sunday in particular, is that it was gratuitous, it wasn't serving the story, it didn't need to be there. And I think actually I kind of agree with that. I think that death needed to be there. I think that obviously violence is going to be. But I did feel like some of it was just, it was just there to be violent, and it didn't really need to be. And it was kind of stupid. But yeah, gratuitous violence is Kirkman's calling card. Violence that is there for no other purpose than to be violent is Kirkman's calling card. What interests me in storytelling, and in particular this pairing right now, partly just because I'm really writing it a lot, but also because of who these people are, is violence that's not gratuitous. And seeing how far you can push the boundary of violence before it becomes gratuitous. And one of the things that I think is really interesting about that is that these are two characters who normally would never do violence to each other. I mean, they never would. The closest we saw them come to that was Still, and I don't think that either of them was in any danger from violence there, really. Daryl was yelling and throwing stuff around, but I don't think he ever would have hurt her. Him grabbing her the way he did was the closest I think he came, and if you really look at him carefully, he's not grabbing her that hard. You know, she's not fighting him because I think she doesn't feel like in that moment fighting him is a good idea, but she could wriggle free anytime she wanted. So these are characters whose relationship is, by definition, really not violent. So one of the things that interests me about working violence into stuff with these two is not violence that's occurring to other people, although I think that that's interesting and sometimes necessary, because I think that violence is not always a lazy and, in fact, in many ways, a useful way of making sure that something is at stake. But violence between these two I find fascinating because it's just so hard to make it happen. And I've talked about this a little bit with Safe Up Here With You, where these characters actually become quite violent toward each other. Daryl doesn't try to kill Beth, but he fantasizes about killing her in a number of different, really horrific ways. And Beth arguably does try to kill him in a really horrific way. So these characters are being violent to each other in a way that they normally never would. And one of the reasons why I wanted to do that was because I wanted to see if I could get them to a point where that would be reasonable and I wouldn't be making them wildly out of character. It was an experiment. I took something that I thought would be next to impossible, and I tried to write it in such a way that it made sense. And I personally think I succeeded. I think that it works as a premise and as an execution. So I think that because this relationship is so nonviolent by nature, that's an interesting thing to do. And it's one of the reasons why I find it attractive, because I like it when people push boundaries. I like when people explore things that often don't get explored, as much as I love fluff. And in Everything Where It Belongs, I'm doing very much the same thing. Everything Where It Belongs is violent in every possible way. It's emotionally violent, it's physically violent, it's mentally violent. It's just violence. And it's violence between these two characters. Pretty much all from Daryl's end. Which is also interesting because his relationship with violence is so particular because of what was done to him. He's had tremendous violence of some of the worst kind done to him. And I think that because of that, his relationship with violence is interesting and complicated. He clearly is willing to do it. And he can be very good at it in terms of hurting people. But I've never gotten the sense that he enjoys it. He may enjoy feeling powerful on some level in the way that violence allows you to do, but I don't think he likes it, and I don't think that it's his first choice regarding engagement with people, and I really think that you see this toward the end of 5A, where he really doesn't want to do that. I meant in 5B, but also in 5A, his first choice is not to storm the castle, and then in 5B, his first choice is absolutely not to take the AOC by force, and he really backs off that when Rick and Carol try to get him into that. So he doesn't like violence and doesn't go for it first. And that's one of the reasons why I think he's so interesting in season one. Also, I just think his character hadn't been developed all that well. You know, he's very violent in the sense of throwing things around and yelling and threatening people. But I think that's just because violence is sort of the language that he knows. The people he's grown up around are violent, casually. The people he's probably just hung around with since then are violent, casually. Merle is clearly violent, casually. And, you know, we don't know who else he's made his company, but, I mean, it's probably the same kinds of people. When you are upset, you get violent, even if it's just yelling and throwing stuff and not actually hurting people. So he does that because it's what he knows. But I think that the second he's shown a different way of doing stuff, he jumps for it because he didn't really want to be doing the other thing in the first place. And he's overjoyed that there is another way to go with people. So I love putting him in situations where he is overwhelmingly violent. And in Everything Where It Belongs, he's actually taking a really sick kind of pleasure in it. And hates it. Hates that he's doing that. But is. And I wanted to see if I could get him there. And I wanted to see if I could get him there in regards to Beth. And I really think that that's interesting. And I think that it's also deeply troubling. And it's one of the reasons why I'm kind of surprised in some ways that people are still reading that thing. And believe me, it's not over. I'm sure I'm not surprising anybody by saying that. But one kind of violence I really don't think I could ever do and have him be in character is, again, manipulation and mind games and things like gaslighting. I just don't think he could ever do that. Physically hurt somebody? Absolutely. Fuck around with somebody in a really cruel way? No. Even if I was stretching to my absolute maximum, I don't think I could make that work. Now, moving on to something else that related, that people had some strong feelings about, that I myself have strong feelings about. You know, we've talked about just basic physical violence, sort of emotional violence, warnings for it, which are obviously really important because you don't want to have somebody just wander into this stuff and fall into a tiger pit. Sexual violence, which I think is fascinating. And that's one that people, if they're okay with graphic violence in general, sexual violence is something they don't want to go near, a lot of them. And I completely understand. Because graphic violence between these two, physical violence between these two, even if it's really intense, you can make that work. And it in itself is not necessarily incredibly disturbing in a way that's just, you know, you want to look away. Sexual violence is awful because it takes intimacy between these two. And one of the things about intimacy between these two characters, sexual or not, is that it involves such an intense degree of trust. On Beth's part, certainly. But Beth, I think, although she's not stupid about this, clearly, she's very bright and she's very perceptive, Beth is quicker to trust people because she doesn't immediately see the worst in people. If somebody's a bad person, I think she knows it instantly. But her default is not to assume that she's going to be hurt by somebody if she allows them to get close. Daryl does. For Daryl, trust is difficult and important, and when he's given it to somebody, if they betray that, they can hurt him worse than just about anything else. Because, again, of how he grew up, and of just about everything that's ever happened to him since then. So, one of the things that's so terrible about intimate partner violence, and especially about sexual violence, when you're not talking about sexual violence between strangers, which is, you know, the minority of the sexual violence that actually occurs, sexual violence between two people who are intimately connected is one of the worst kinds of betrayals you can imagine. And I think it's a kind of betrayal that normal physical violence is just absolutely not. And I'm counting any kind of sexual violence in this. I'm counting, you know, actual rape, attempted rape, anything involving consent issues, anything involving physical violence with a sexual aspect. Anything like that between these two characters is by nature going to be just unutterably horrific in a way that it really wouldn't necessarily be with any other pairing, I think, in quite this way. Not that it wouldn't be horrific between other pairings, but not in this way, because the dynamic is so specific. And this is a place where somebody asked me, is there anywhere you wouldn't go? And I've already said that, yeah, I mean, there's some places I won't go that don't even have anything to do with violence or disturbing stuff in the way that we normally think of it. They're just some stories I will not tell. There's some stories I don't want to go near because that's outside my comfort zone in a way that I don't want to approach because I'm actually quite happy often to go outside my comfort zone. But somebody asked me if there's anything that I wouldn't do, and sexual violence is not included in that. I would absolutely do that. If you look at the tags for Everything Where It Belongs, you'll see that sexual violence is in there. Now, it's in there for a specific reason in a specific scene. It's not sexual violence, I think, in the sense that most people would necessarily think of it, and it's not in there for any kind of actual rape or sexual assault. There's just something that Daryl does at one point that you could argue, because of the context in which it's done and because of specifically what he does, is sexually violent. It's violent with a sexual aspect. But sexual violence is something that I think has the capacity to be unbelievably disturbing in this pairing. It is something that I understand that most people don't want. I think that probably this is something that most people would avoid like the plague. And it is something that, for that reason, interests me immensely. It's something that I would be reluctant to read it, but that's only because I know of very few authors who I would trust to be able to do it well. And I'm including the people I don't trust to do it well. I'm including good writers in that. It's not that I think that if you can't do it well, you're a bad writer. I just think that you need to be great, for one thing, and you need to be a particular kind of writer, I think, in order to be able to do it well. By which I mean do it in a way that it's just not radically out of character. Construct a setting in which it makes sense and then be able to pull it off. Because it's so hard, it's something that intrigues me a lot more than just violence. I have said, you know, a couple times I think now, that I love when boundaries get pushed. That I think that some of the most interesting things happen in terms of exploring character and in terms of exploring relationships when you take something that you aren't sure you can get past and you push it as hard as you can without actually going over into stuff that doesn't work. So I'm for that reason, and I don't know, perhaps for some unconsciously unsavory reasons, my mind is a fucked up place, and I'm not going to pretend that that's not the case. I'm fascinated by that idea. Now, there are different kinds of sexual violence, and I don't think that you can make all of them work in this particular case. One of the things that people mentioned clearly, I mean, because I think this is probably one of the first places you go in your head, is outright rape. I think personally that you could write that in such a way that it worked. I would be very reluctant to try. But it's something that I don't rule out trying, and it's something that, again, intrigues me a lot, and that I probably will try at some point. Just fair warning. At some point I'm probably going to go there, assuming I'm in this fandom long enough to do it. Anything where consent issues are present. I mean, I've done that. I've already done that. There is a scene where consent is arguably not present. Something sexual happens and consent is arguably not present, and in fact cannot be present, in Safe Up Here With You. And it's minor in terms of, you know, it's not violent and it's not intensely horrifying, I think, or lengthy, or it doesn't go very far. It's just a few seconds of something, but, there's no consent. And Daryl knows it, and he does it anyway. And I was, in a sick way, kind of proud of that, because I thought that I pulled it off really well. And a lot of the people who read it seemed to agree. But I think that that's really difficult to handle, again, with this particular relationship. I do think that slipping into stuff where consent is questionable is a lot easier than actually doing outright rape, because of what rape is and how it works, and I think of how you'd need to write it. Doing stuff that is sexually problematic and disturbing and fucked up, I mean, we can do that with daddy kink, but one of the things that I really like to write in my daddy kink, and you can do daddy kink in a way that is not this. You can do daddy kink in a way that's incredibly abusive and violent. I like to write my daddy kink in a way that is very clear. I don't think I could do this in any other way. That it's very clear that enthusiastic consent is very much present, that both people are having a really good time. And in fact, that in a lot of it, it's just sweet and gentle. And it's nice, to the extent that something that's fucked up can be nice. I really make it clear that there are no negative feelings here whatsoever, that everybody's just having a fantastic time. So that, I feel like, strays away from violence in a lot of ways. But it could go into the realm of violence if you wanted to go there. Something that somebody else mentioned that's part of this is degradation. And anything that degrades somebody, anything that reduces somebody's humanity, I mean, sexual violence by nature does that because you're violating somebody's body. And anytime you violate someone's body in any way, you're dehumanizing them. Violence is fundamentally dehumanizing. Because the second you can do violence to somebody else, you are placing them in a state of diminished humanity. There's no other way to do it. You can't be violent against somebody that you regard as fully human. It's not possible to do it, and we know that because the only way that we can actually make people be violent in, like, a military setting is if we dehumanize them a little bit. And in fact, in many cases, quite a lot. So violence by nature is degrading because it's just dehumanizing. But sexual violence is degrading in a particular way because sex is so much a part of your identity. So if you are sexually violating somebody in a way that is humiliating, that is not just objectifying them in the sense of you are a thing that I can do whatever I want to, but, you know, making them not just less than human, but saying you're worthless, you're filthy, you're not worth anything. That is something that I think is even worse between these two characters, and that I think is even harder to write. And in fact, I don't know that I could write that. I've written that playfully in Pacify, but not even really that much. I mean, yeah, especially with Rick, it happens a little bit, but, you know, absolutely not seriously. Because, again, I think that goes so deep into a part of Daryl that I think he would just never let that come out. Even if he was doing something else awful, I just don't think he would allow that to emerge. He can hurt somebody and dehumanize them to that extent, but I just don't see him being able to emotionally tear somebody down in that way. He's clearly done it in other ways, but I just don't, for whatever reason, I just don't see that happening and being in character. Although I would love to see somebody try. That would be, you know, interesting. So jumping off of violence for a second and going to something else that I think is intrinsic to this ship and something that a lot of people have very mixed feelings about. And in fact, is something that I've flirted with in kind of a mean, manipulative way. I won't pretend that's not true. And may do. In fact, it's not that I may do it. I guarantee you at some point I will do this, and I might do it soon. Character death. And not character death in the past. I'm not talking about things set, you know, after Coda or during Coda. I'm talking about a separate story where one or both of them dies. A number of people expected me to end Safe Up Here With You that way. I didn't, clearly. Nobody dies. Spoiler alert. Nobody fucking dies in that thing. People thought... I was actually a little surprised that people would think that I would end that story that way, but some people thought that the second-to-last chapter of I'll Be Yours for a Song ends with Daryl's death. I was implying that pretty strongly. I ended in such a way that you might think that happened, but I didn't honestly expect most people to think that I would go there. A lot of people seemed to think that I did in their comments on that chapter, which was interesting to me in terms of gauging people's opinions of me as a writer. People in this fandom have very strong feelings about character death. I don't even think that we need to analyze that too strongly. I think that our feelings about character death would be different had Coda not occurred. I think that there are a lot of scars going around regarding the deaths of either of these characters, but I mean, like, I think especially Beth, because of the context in which we've experienced actual character death. Actual for real character death. That kind of thing isn't something you really get over too easily, if at all. And for that reason, a number of people expressed unwillingness to go there, and a couple of people said that they didn't expect it. It happened in a fic, and they found it incredibly disturbing and like, put the thing down, would have thrown it across the room if it was a book, and just never went back to it, and kind of never trusted that author again. I particularly, because I don't want to hurt anybody in a way that's... I want to hurt people. When I write disturbing, upsetting things, I'm out to hurt you. I really try to make that clear, so people don't come in expecting me to be nice or merciful and then become upset when it turns out that I'm, like, the cruelest motherfucker when I get cruel. Like, I really want to hurt you. Not only hurt you, I want to fuck with your head. Like, I want to make you think things are good and then turn around and just make them the worst they've ever been. If something appears to be getting better, that just means it's going to get worse again. When I'm telling this particular kind of story, not all my fics are that way. Clearly not all my fics are that way. But one of the things about being able to effectively gut punch, and I want a gut punch, I take sick joy in the effective gut punch. When people go, oh my God, and they kind of have to take a step back and maybe get, like, really upset. Not so upset that they leave. That's the thing. It's a fine line to draw. I want to upset people, but not so much that they're not with me until the end. And it's hard to walk that line sometimes. I want to get people right up to the point of turning away and then have them stay with me. And then ideally, by the time we get to the end, they feel like it was worth the journey. They don't walk away feeling angry. I don't want people to walk away feeling like it was Coda. I don't want people to just walk away in disgust and never trust me again. I want people to stay with me through unbelievable pain and come out the other end and feel like maybe that wasn't fun, but it was worth it and I see why all of that happened. And I don't think that it was there for no reason. That's what I want, ideally. But I want to go right up to the edge of that. I want to hurt you. Bad. And one of the ways in which you hurt somebody, I mean, you can hurt somebody just through kind of a slow, creeping awfulness. And I like to do that. I really enjoy that. But you can also hurt somebody, and I really enjoy this too, just by completely gut-punching them out of nowhere. You think you're okay? Oh, you are fucking not. Ha! Bet you didn't see that coming. I really like doing that. It can be cheap. I try not to do it in such a way that it's cheap, but I like to gut punch. The problem with doing that effectively is that people can't know that it's coming. If people know that it's coming at them, they can brace themselves or duck. And I don't want people to do that. I'm incredibly mean, but I don't want people to do that. I want people to be completely caught out of nowhere. Or if they know that something bad's coming, I don't want them to know when and how and where. I want them to be surprised because it hurts so much more. But I also want to warn for things. You know, if I'm going to write a story with sexual assault in it, I might want the sexual assault to be a gut punch, but I also don't want people going into the story not knowing that that's going to happen at some point. I don't want people going into a story not knowing that I'm going to kill a character. But that's really troubling in terms of how you walk that particular line. Walking the line where you don't hurt people so badly that they leave is in itself very difficult to walk. Walking the line where you want to hurt people as much as you can, but not so much that they don't actually leave, but you also really recognize that some people need to know that something's going to happen. Otherwise, you know, it might go beyond just upsetting them. It might send them into a panic attack, which I absolutely don't want to fucking do. I want to avoid that at all costs. So something like sexual violence, or any other particular kind of violence that I think is likely to be particularly triggering or particularly disturbing, I feel like I have to warn for that. The problem is when you do that, you've diminished the gut punch a little bit, which is something that I don't love. I recognize that it's necessary, but I don't love it. So the sort of the middle ground that I found to walk is it's kind of in the tags. I'll let you know that it's coming, but I won't tell you when. And I won't tell you how, and I won't tell you who's doing what to whom. There have been a couple of points, both in Safe Up Here With You and in Everything Where It Belongs, where I have given additional warnings at the beginnings of chapters when I think things are especially terrible. Not satisfactory, but I'm trying. Like, I think it's in a field of unideal options, it's, I think, the best that I can do. And I think it's the best that I can expect anybody to do. Character death is really hard because I think you gotta warn for it. I think you have to tag a fit character death if you're going to do it. But, you know, you don't necessarily want to tell somebody that that's coming. And without giving away the farm here, it's possible that it's one of the things I'm writing now. It's possible that it's one of the things I will write very soon. I'm not telling you which. But character will die in that. And it won't be a fake death, like I'll Be Yours for a Song. We're talking real death. It may not be one of the ones I'm writing now. Could be something coming. Being an asshole. I'm really sorry. But the question that I'm then faced with is, do I put that in the tags from the get-go? Or do I tag it shortly before it happens or when it happens? And I don't know the answer to that. And I'm well aware that the way in which I handle that might make people angry. When people thought I had actually killed Daryl and I'll Be Yours for a Song, a lot of them were enraged. They were just so fucking angry. And I think that one of the reasons why they were so angry, and I think this is completely justifiable, is that they thought that I had done it without letting them know that it was coming. The thing is, ideally, in a perfect world, I would have done it without letting them know it was coming. I would have done that. That's awful, but I would have done that because I would want it to hurt as much as possible. But this is a particular fandom with a history and a context in which I think that that's something that you have to default to warning for. I think it's something that it makes sense to do, and is in fact quite interesting, because I think that loss and reactions to death are so fascinating because they're so different depending on the character and the setting and the situation and the context. No death is alike, and lots of deaths mean different things. But I understand why people really don't want to do it, and I understand why people really don't want it. It's kind of like sexual violence. I'm all for it. I love it. I love the idea of it. I want it to be explored to its fullest extent. But it's also something that I understand that people just don't want to go near. And I mean, I think that's true of a lot of different things. I want to briefly talk about horror. And I want to talk about horror, first of all, because I love horror and I'm a horror writer. And also because, again, the show is arguably horror in and of itself. But horror is so much of a complicated thing. And I think that in a lot of ways, horror as a genre is still very marginalized. Like I said, I primarily in my career, I've moved within science fiction and fantasy circles, and some in romance, but not really. And of genre fiction, it's my sense that horror is really marginalized in a way that maybe I don't even think romance is. Romance is huge, but romance is marginalized too in a lot of gendered ways that are gross. And I think one of the reasons why horror is marginalized is because people regard it as kind of childish and stupid because of the gore factor. And, you know, I kind of agree with that, because it is childish and stupid. That said, I don't like that because it means that there are a lot of really great things about horror that just don't get recognized. And there is fantastic work that just kind of gets ignored because it is within a genre that has a bad name. Now, you can have horror just be gory, and I would still call that horror, but when I write horror, and I think that the best horror on the show, because I think the show's done this quite well too, is the horror that is almost purely psychological. And I think body horror is also a thing, and I love it. David Cronenberg is one of my very favorite directors. I love body horror. And I love body horror because bodies are so emotionally important to us. Terrible things happening to your body. Not even necessarily violence being done to your body, but your body changing in a way that you don't control and that is really destructive and terrible, that's a kind of horror that I think is visceral in a way that just damage doesn't really do. So one of the things that I tag everything where it belongs as psychological horror. It is. Daryl's hallucinations are horrific. I mean, they're awful. I'm drawing on my own nightmares heavily for that. I'm also drawing on stuff that's really terrified me that I've watched, like Jacob's Ladder. Love that movie, but it's one of the scariest fucking movies I've ever seen. I recommend it, but cautiously. It's great, but oh my god. But one of the things that Daryl hallucinates, or some of the things that Daryl hallucinates that are, I think, really horrific, because I have particular issues with this stuff, are insects. And in particular, insects inside his body. He hallucinates / imagines maggots in his brain. Because his brain's been damaged really badly. And decay and death have become so much a part of his identity, of how he sees himself. And I would argue that that's body horror. But I would argue that it's also psychological horror because of where it's hitting you and where it's hitting me. And I think that that really is the most effective horror. And I really like that kind of horror. And I think that because the psychology between these two characters is so deep and so fundamental, that kind of horror is really worth doing. It's worth taking this very healthy relationship, this very intimate relationship, this very deep relationship, and saying, okay, how mentally and emotionally can I fuck this up? How much dread can I inject into what's going on here? How much fear can I put into it? What happens when you are no longer sure what's happening and what's not? What happens when you don't trust your own perception anymore? Which leads, and this happens in Safe Up Here With You, to you not being sure that you can trust this person anymore. You aren't sure that they have your best interests in mind. You don't trust them to take care of you. You don't trust them not to hurt or kill you. Loss of trust of everything you perceive is one of the things that I personally find the most horrifying. And that's part and parcel of mental illness, which is also something that I wrote about in Safe Up Here With You and am writing about currently in Everything Where It Belongs. Those two fics really are companions. I think they can be read and should be read together. And I love writing horror in that way. And I think that horror is kind of difficult to tag for. You can tag something for psychological horror and disturbing themes, but it's deep enough and complicated enough that I'm not sure how you effectively warn for it. But I love it and I think it's very much worth doing. And I would love to see more people try it, because I honestly don't think it's something that I see people try very often. And I there's a lot of stuff that's dark and disturbing that I don't think I see a lot of people do, and I would like to see just in general more of it, to the extent that people feel like they can. Now, finally, if I can squeeze this in before my husband comes home, because I find it very awkward to record when he's here. One of the things that I do think is great about all of this, it's great for me, I think that it's great for the fandom in general, it's great for all of us, as a whole, as a community, is that there's so much here that's cathartic. We all were very upset about what happened after CODA. We are very upset about it still. I think a lot of us are really angry. I think that something I noticed about CODA afterward is that there was a lot of fix-it stuff, and there was a lot of fluff, there was a lot of happiness. But I also saw tons of gift sets and images and edits that were terrible. I mean, they were just the most depressing fucking things ever. And I think that one of the reasons why I saw a lot of those is because it was part of our processing. It was part of how we were kind of getting through what had happened to us emotionally as a community through art. And I think that that's one of the reasons why we love disturbing themes and love horror, those of us who do. this is so deeply wrapped up in catharsis. Going to these dark places is about bringing these things into the light in a way that they're less powerful, they're less painful, and we can confront them in a way that we can get past them. It's one of the reasons why I like writing about terrible stuff. It's one of the reasons why I'm writing about mental illness in the way that I am, in Everything Where It Belongs. So I think that ultimately that's the real value of this stuff, and that's one of the reasons why I seek it out. It's not just that it's entertaining, it's not just that I think it's interesting. It's that I think that there's real catharsis in it, and I think that's incredibly valuable. And what I love about this particular ship is that the catharsis is working in a particular way. It's something that I really enjoy and think is incredibly worthwhile. So, I don't have a whole lot more to say about that. I've been talking for forever, and I think my husband's coming home like any fucking minute, so I'm gonna go ahead and jump to the reading. And the reading is so fucking depressing, I'm just gonna warn you. The reading is really depressing. It involves hallucination and mental illness, there's some self-harm, and I would say it probably doesn't really have a happy ending. It's just fucking awful. I love it. I fucking love it. I was so happy to be able to read it. It's Scar Tissue by The Vampire Cat. It's available on Archive of Our Own. I really encourage you to go read it because it's beautiful, and me reading it isn't going to necessarily capture all of it in terms of its beauty. So I'm going to go to that now. I hope you enjoy it in the sense that you enjoy horrible, horrible, painful things. Scar Tissue by Punky Nemo, the Vampire Cat. What are you doing? It's her. He's not surprised. She does this sometimes. Turns up out of nowhere. Sits with him. Pretends this is normal, that everything's okay. He'll be doing something, not even thinking about her in as much as he ever isn't thinking about her. And then suddenly there she'll be, stepping through the veil and into his world like it's no big deal. Like there's a place waiting for her here and she's claiming it. Like everything didn't fall apart in that hallway in a hospital at the end of the world. So they'll sit and they'll talk, and she'll say all the things he can't, and his heart will stop this business of breaking, if only for a moment. Sometimes she's so real he almost believes she is. She'll hum old songs his ma used to sing, songs she couldn't possibly know. Vivid, vibrant, and so close he imagines he can hear her pulse racing, blood pumping through her veins. Other times she lingers on the periphery, fluttering, nervous even, like she's not sure she's welcome, like that could be a thing. He'd say she's nuts because, well, she is, and a bullet through the brain doesn't change that. But if he did, he knows it would lead to a bunch of questions about what it actually means to be nuts, and he's pretty damn sure he'd come up short in light of current events and all. But she's not fluttering, not this time. This time she's sitting at the table across from him. She's bold and bright, and the afternoon sunlight, streaming through the window, gleams golden against her hair. It doesn't surprise him, these impromptu visits. They used to. They used to make him think he was losing his fucking mind, and there was a time, a long, long time ago, when he railed against that. But not now. Not anymore. Because now he's come to understand that there's a perverse logic to this, a twisted and yet somehow calculated pragmatism to the way his crumbling psyche tries to reorganize all the pieces and fit them back together in an order that makes some kind of sense. Daryl? He glances up at her, away from what he's doing. She's beautiful. All bright eyes and smooth skin, silver earrings and glittering bracelets creating a sparkling kaleidoscope of light and color between them, dust motes swirling and dancing in the sunshine. He swears he can smell lilies, and beneath that the earthy scent of her flesh. God, girl, please stay. This time. Just this once. He knows it's all kinds of fucked up. But this is not healing, or feeling in the way maybe someone like Aaron would see it. There's something very broken in all of this, and he's not sure he wants to fix it. She says his name again, soft this time, coaxing almost. He feels like a small child being asked to show his crayon scribblings to a teacher. His picture. His art. He can't say no, so he holds out his hands to her. Here. Here is my work. Take it. Do what you want with it. It's his vest. Leather soft with age, but hard with grime. Worn and torn and smooth under his calloused hands. A contradiction. He guesses the same could be said of him. She tilts her head to the side, brow furrowed. Her hair still has that single braid. Her face still has those double scars. She runs her fingers over the left wing where he's ham-handedly started to unpick the stitching. The frayed material stands stiff and torn, adorned with years of grit and death. "Why?" she asks. He shrugs, ducks his head, mumbles. He can swear he feels leather move as her fingers glide across it, even though that shouldn't be possible. "Don't," she says. "Why?" "Tor," he says. "Crashed the bike. It ripped on the road." She nods, sits back in the chair. He tells himself it didn't creak when she did. "You don't want to fix it?" she asks. "Maggie could do it. Carol." He shakes his head, pulls the vest back into his lap. "Don't need him. Just gonna tear more." She nods again, but her frown deepens, blue eyes turning to ice, sharp teeth worrying her bottom lip. There's a question coming, a question and an answer. Who's Daryl Dixon without his wings? A nothing, a nobody. "That isn't true, Daryl," she says softly, and he wonders if he said it aloud, if it even matters if he did. He looks away, doesn't answer, and starts to pick at the stitching again, until another section of dirty fabric pulls free. The leather he uncovers beneath is darker, harder, not faded and beaten. White wings now replaced for black, devils for angels. He runs his fingers over the tiny holes left by needle and thread. They're not too noticeable, haven't damaged the leather too much. It'll be okay. He tugs again, almost there. The wing comes off entirely, a single thread attaching it to the vest. He reaches for the knife at his waist, its sharp blade gleaming, little ivory hilt delicate and pretty, and slices through the cotton, tosses the frayed wing onto the table, just in front of her. She leans forward to peer at it, hair falling in her eyes, rigid scar across the porcelain of her cheek. And that other scar. Oh, God. The little starburst high on her forehead that took every goddamn thing away and gave only grief and despair in return. "God, girl, why did you have to leave me?" He starts on the next wing. "You're taking both?" she asks. Her voice is tight now, worried. He nods. "Why?"
"You know."
He doesn't stop. He slices through the thread, quick, even strokes. "Can't be an angel with only one wing, girl," he says. Ludicrous. He was never an angel. There's some things even he can't pretend are real. She sighs, fingers the material again, running her hands down the lines of each feather. Back up again, tracing their outline against the wood of the table. "What is it?" he asks, and it's fucking out of this world ridiculous that he's so comfortable with this, that he can just talk to her like he once did, that she's as fucking real to him as all the rest. Maybe more real in some ways. She shrugs, little hitch of her shoulders. "Just don't know if it's you without the wings," she says. "Don't know what's going to protect you now." He snaps another thread. It seems louder than it should. "Don't need protection, girl." "Never relied on anyone for anything," she whispers. He wonders sometimes, when this happens, where she starts and he ends. How much of this is his memory of her, and how much is just him. It's not that he doesn't know what this is. He's broken. He might be crazy, but he's not stupid. It's not like she's telling him anything new, anything he doesn't know or hasn't thought of. By nature of what she is, she can't. But sometimes, God, sometimes, this is just so fucking cruel, because he knows he's losing it, knows he's falling deeper and deeper into that haze of blurred edges and lost voices, and yet his mind is somehow still razor sharp and ready to strike at all his weak points, rub salt in his still gaping wounds, killing him slowly, exquisitely, with infinite care. He's always known something dark exists inside him, something insidiously cruel with teeth and nails, some twisted little scorpion that stings hard and fast and then retreats back under a rock to watch everything fall apart. He knows because he's seen it come out to play, seen how vile he can be. "You lost two boyfriends and you couldn't even shed a tear. I never cut my wrists for attention. You're never going to see Maggie again." But now that scorpion has turned on him. And maybe it's not truly vicious. Not yet, at least, but it's toying with him. Batting him about like an errant child torturing a fly. Pulling his goddamn wings off. A while ago, he forgets exactly when because the day is all blur into one now, Aaron tried to get him to talk to someone. Not about this. Not about how he sees her and talks to her, and it's like nothing changed except for the smooth porcelain skin of her face. Not about that. But about Beth all the same. About why he's so eager to get away all the time. Why he's always willing to be the sacrifice. The martyr. About how he'll come back from fights and runs and find bruises and cuts and scrapes on his body and not remember how they got there. How he'll find cigarette burns on his hands and know exactly how they did. It didn't work. The shrink was nice enough at first. Blonde, friendly, scared out of her fucking mind. She asked the right questions, said the right things. He gave the wrong answers and didn't say enough things. Her approach, though, that was interesting enough to make him really wonder how good a shrink she was. Platitudes and war cries, cutesy slogans and meaningless truths which weren't truths at all. She told him she could work with him, and he said he didn't want to. Told her to save her breath and shrink her own fucking head, and she could start by getting rid of all those stupid clichés she stored up in there. She told him she knew it was hard, that grief is hard, that losing people was cruel and senseless and awful, and boy did she know that they'd all lost someone. So he got up and walked out. Because if he hadn't, if he'd stayed, he would have said, Beth. Her name was Beth. And he would have let it loose on the world. Said her name into the haze and lost it. Wouldn't have been fast enough to shove it back in his mouth. But he didn't say it. Didn't free her. Because he's selfish. Because he wants to keep her for himself. He never went back. He doesn't know which one of them that comforts more. And now Beth is here. Not glimmering, not glowing, not snapping in and out of existence like these things are wont to do. She's just there, so real that he could disappear in the lie forever. You sure you just want to trash these? She asks again. Spoken, girl. He cuts through more thread, eases the second wing away from the leather. You can fix broken things, Daryl, she says. It's hard, and it's slow, and sometimes it takes a lot of work, but you can fix them. He stops, looks across the table at her, how solid she is, real enough that he can smell her, that he can feel the air move when she does, the tap of her boots on the floor. Not me, girl. Maybe you. Not me. She smiles, and it's so fucking sad that he nearly up and goes to her, kneels on the floor at her feet. I think you could, Daryl. I think you could fix it. She's not here. He knows she's not. That she's never set foot inside this house, this place. And he has to wonder why some fractured and overwhelmed part of his psyche is railing so hard against cutting off his wings. Why it means so damn much. It'll be okay, he says, resuming his work, pulling at the small embedded thread with his fingernails, trying hard not to damage the leather any further. And maybe it will be. After all, it's just fabric, something old and stained, dark even. A stark difference to rich cream color they used to be all those years ago when he found the vest lying at the bottom of a charity store junk trunk. I don't know, she says. Are you sure? God, girl, I'm still here, ain't I? I lost my ma, and then I lost Merle, and then I fucking lost you too, and somehow I'm still here. I don't think a few scrappy, discolored fake wings are gonna change that. They ain't fake, Daryl. She startles him again. Sometimes he forgets that he doesn't need to speak out loud when she's here. Sometimes he forgets everything. They ain't real, he says. He's almost done. He's taken most of it off, just a few feathers near the tip clinging on for dear life. You think I'm not real, she says. It's a statement, not a question. And she just sounds so fucking lost that he puts everything down and is halfway reaching for her hand before he can stop himself. But she jerks away slightly, like she always does when this happens. He knows what that is, too. His broken, fucked-up mind trying to preserve the fantasy, trying to keep her here. Touch her and she'll disappear, and she might not come back. And if he was healthy and stable, that would be the right thing to do. End it now. Send her away. Unbreak his mind. But he sees her, for fuck's sake. He sees her as clear as day, and even if he didn't want her to be here, didn't miss her so much every goddamn hour of every goddamn day, didn't carry the weight of that with him wherever he goes, the very fact that he sees her is enough to tell him that whatever has fallen apart inside him, whatever is torn, can't be mended. It needs to be left alone to fester, or cut out completely. And he doesn't know how much of himself would go with it. How much of him is even left. He pulls his hand back, lets it rest between them, flat on the table. Scars and dirt and ink. Tan skin, calloused and worn. No, but... No, girl. You ain't real. He says it gently. There's no need to be cruel. He's done that enough. He can be kind, even to his own fantasy. It's so fucking tragic, though. Sitting here watching her, seeing her eyes fill with tears, imaginary or not. It could be worse. It could be like those first times he saw her when he raged and screamed and threw things at her. At her and through her. "Why did you leave me, girl?" He asks and he knows the answer won't make sense. It can't. Because he doesn't know why she's gone. Because he should have got her back. Because he was meant to save her. He was meant to win this time. If you want God to laugh, tell him your plans. He just never thought God wouldn't be on her side. But still. Why, girl? Why? He doesn't want to say they could have had it all. He's old and wise enough to know that's a platitude as empty as any the shrink vomited out at him. They couldn't have had it all. But they could have had something. And something is better than nothing. But maybe nothing is better than this. He doesn't know. That's one of the problems with a fractured mind, a broken vision of the world. Reality stops mattering all that much. She doesn't answer. She can't. Instead, she plays with the wings, dainty little hands turning them over and over. He wonders what this would look like to someone watching from the outside. If the wings would just be lying on the table, discarded, forgotten, or if they'd be suspended in the air, turning seemingly of their own volition. He knows the answer. But sometimes it feels so good to pretend. "Seems a shame, though," she says, holding them up together, shaking them a little. And if he squints, it looks like they're flying. "Shame to lose it." He nods. He tries not to choke, not to sob. "Can I have them?" "You can have whatever you like, girl." She smiles, and for a moment he allows himself to believe she is really there, that she made it, that she survived, that she did all those things she said she could. And it feels so good. "Thanks," she says quietly. God, he misses her so much. The hole inside him open and gaping, sucking in everything that's good and innocent, everything that makes all of this worthwhile, stripping him piece by piece, bone and sinew, veins, flesh, taking it all. He tries to find the room for it, to make some place where he can store it, close it off, and stop it from consuming him. But he can't. Some things you can't make room for. Some things are just too big. He doesn't know if she knows that. And suddenly Aaron's at the door, knocking gently on the wood, calling him to get his lazy ass downstairs. It's Eric's birthday, and they're having a thing, because here in this safe zone they have things. Parties, get-togethers, functions. And he fucking hates them, but they're apparently routine. Traditional. How they all delude one another into believing everything is okay and they can have a normal life. And then they all drink themselves stupid when they can't keep pretending anymore. But then again, maybe he shouldn't be so judgy about delusions. "You need to go?" she asks, and he nods. "Got a thing. Birthdays, picnics, and summer holidays." She bites her lip, and for an awful moment it looks like she's fighting tears again. "I wish I could go with you," she whispers. "Oh, God, my girl. So do I." And before she breaks his heart again today, he clips her knife to his belt and forces himself to walk out of the room and not look back. Drink. Talk. Drink again. It'll all be over soon. It doesn't matter. Especially when it does. When he comes back later, a little too drunk to feel much of anything, a new and brighter cigarette burn on his hand, the wings are gone. His table empty except for a few tiny threads and his vest with its newer, darker marks, angels replaced with devils. He wonders where they are. If someone came in here and cleaned up, took them. But his head is swimming and his hand is aching, and he falls into bed and doesn't dream. And when he wakes up, his mouth is cotton wool and his flesh is blistered and festered like his mind and his heart, and he doesn't think about it again. And for a while after that, he passes for okay, even though he's not. He goes with Aaron to recruit. He kills walkers. He saves people. He finds food and supplies, reinforces the walls and fences, and even sets up a rotation with Abraham to make sure the guard posts are always manned. He watches Rick spiral out of control and Carol fight her demons, and he's not sure she wins. Judith grows exponentially, and it's hard to believe how little time has passed since the world ended, and then ended again. She doesn't visit. He doesn't feel the need to hurt himself or anyone else. That evil little scorpion goes to hide under his rock, likely biding its time, but he's grateful for the reprieve. Maybe he gets stronger while it does too. Maybe there's a cosmic battle at the end of all this. The battle for Daryl Dixon's soul. Yeah, he can be melodramatic if he wants. He sees ghosts, visions of dead people. He's earned it. It's a good run, but like any, it comes to an end. It's her birthday. She would have been 20. So he takes a bottle of moonshine and goes into the woods at night, puts another cigarette out on his hand and tries to burn her out of him and into him, and fuck, he just doesn't know anymore. And the pain slams into him, rushes through his nerves and feeds that void inside, if only for a moment. And then he's falling and spiraling, and all he wants to do is run off into oblivion after her. And he remembers her asking what's going to protect him when that happens. Beth. Her name is Beth. And he's not surprised to hear her singing. Something low and sweet. Something he doesn't know. Something his ma never sang. He's also not surprised to see the scuffed toes of her boots standing in the leaves in front of him. But he can't bring himself to look at her, to let her see this. So he doesn't. He lets her lean in close, so close he can feel the heat of her skin, and he focuses on her pulse jumping at her neck, the way the muscles in her throat work. And he wonders how his imagination can be so vivid, how he sees so much, and also so little. But he closes his eyes, falls into the lie as she tugs the cigarette out of his fingers, nicotine-stained, and older than he cares to admit, and crushes it with her heel. He feels her breath against his face, and wonders if this time she'll touch him, and everything will disappear. And then she does. And it doesn't. She runs her fingers through his hair, down his cheek, and he turns his face and kisses her palm, and leans into her because she's so warm and so solid. It's not real. He knows this. He also knows that this is a turning point, and he wonders what it means, and how far he's fallen. And then she's gone, her warmth in her skin, and he hears her walking away, boots crunching on the autumn leaves, and he opens his eyes to watch her, to see the moonlight glinting off her corn silk hair, those tiny earrings, the beads at her wrist. The long, ivory expanse of the wings down her back.
There. God, wasn't that depressing? I'm actually recording this a couple of days after I did that recording, because time and work and stuff. And I just finished doing the music for it, and I'm really proud of it, you guys, and I really hoped you liked it. So yeah, that's the end of the show. I'm still weirded out by calling this a show. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. As usual, we are Keep Singing Podcast. .wordpress.com. That is where our website is. And also we are on iTunes, so if that is where you get your podcasts from, you can subscribe there, and if you feel like it, you can rate it and review it and whatever. No pressure, but it's cool if you want to. I should be back with you in 3 weeks or so. I have no idea what I'm going to be doing, but hopefully it will be awesome. In the meantime, let's hope tomorrow doesn't suck, and let's hope the intervening episodes don't suck either, I guess. Yeah. Being a fan of this show is no fun, is it? All right. Well, anyway, until then, bye.